Good morning, Your Honor.
May I please report, counsel? Thank you. On behalf of Mr. Castro, this case revolves around the enhancements of the firearm enhancement and maintaining a premises enhancement at its sentencing. The first thing I do want to bring to the court's attention, as far as the record goes, there was a statement made by Mr. Castro's lawyer that the magazine to the firearm was found in a drawer. It has come to my attention that it was actually found in the gun case, but it was not loaded and there's no ammunition. But we wanted to make sure we brought that to the court's attention.
Yes, thank you for that.
And credit to Mr. Anderson to bringing it to my attention so we could do that. So I first want to start off with the firearm enhancement. And I think some of these arguments kind of dovetail with each other because the facts are pretty consistent and agreed upon. Is the main issue with the firearm was located in a closet. It did have there was a magazine adjacent to it, but it was not in the firearm. And there was no ammunition found in the apartment in any way, shape, or form. And I think that is critical to the court's analysis of whether or not it was clearly improbable it was connected to the offense.
I thought we had cases saying it doesn't matter if there's no ammunition.
That is true, but I think when you take that fact along with the fact that there's no drug transactions connected to the apartment, I think is critical. And I think they work together. And I think the fact that
but
it's...
But $1 million in proceeds and $250,000 in jewelry in proceeds, I mean, that's stipulated as well.
Yes, that is stipulated as well. But I think when we look, the way we have looked at it is that when you look at the enhancement for the premises, okay, as well as the firearm, there's no drug transactions associated with that house. There's no drugs found there. There's no drugs paraphernalia found there.
But the fear is that if you have drug proceeds in a weapon near it, that the likelihood is that weapon will be at least brandished, if not used. And conflict can arise when weapons are near drug proceeds.
I understand that. I think what the record, though, that's developed in this case, I think is really important, is because...
So give me a carve-out that will protect all those interests.
Well, I think there's a couple things when you look at it is, in this particular case, there was a lot of surveillance done of Mr. Castro, and they followed him to various locations. It's a multi-defendant case, and there's no evidence that in any of the drug transactions that he personally, where he delivered kilos of cocaine, there's any evidence he possessed or carried a firearm during those drug transactions, okay? We agree that the money in the house is proceeds, but the fact that it's unloaded and that there's no ammunition at the house, I think is important. I think the application note that talks about that if it's an unloaded hunting rifle, that wouldn't apply. I think whether it's a hunting rifle or a firearm, I think the operative fact that we will ask the court to focus on is the fact that it's unloaded and there's no ammunition. It's not just because there's a firearm in a closed case near drug proceeds. I think those are the operative facts that show it's not probable it's connected to the offense because it's not at the ready, it's not in a nightstand, it's not in a holster, it's not loaded, there's no magazine in it ready to go. The person would have to physically open the case, insert the magazine, but then before that even find ammunition to do that. So I think with those operative facts and that there's no evidence or admissions that I carried the firearm with me during the drug transactions, delivering cocaine or receiving proceeds, that therefore the enhancement should not apply.
Well, you walk into your stash house for your proceeds, you have a magazine in your pocket, you clip it in your gun, and you're ready to go, and you're going to guard your proceeds. I mean, I'm having a hard time. You're asking us to carve out a special thing for this case, it sounds like, and I don't see how we can protect all the interests, as I said, that the cases have identified.
Well, but I think in reviewing those cases, I think those cases also have proceeds with drugs attached to them. There's drugs located in the house. There's drugs paraphernalia in the house. And so they were part and parcel of that. I have not seen necessarily any cases where there's just solely proceeds and not drug, there's always been drugs associated, whether it's in the storage shed, whether it's in the car, whether it's in the nightstand or in the kitchen, there's drugs with the proceeds. And I think that also ties into the, so we're not, I don't think we're asking the court out an exception. I think what we're asking the court to do is, based on the facts that presented in the record, is it clearly improbable that it was associated with the offense? And I think when you have the facts of it's in a gun case with no ammunition on a shelf in a closet, that those operative facts, that he never carried a firearm, he never had it in his possession during any drug transactions, those operative facts don't support the enhancement. So we're not asking for a carve-out. I think, based on the current state of the law and the facts in this case, that it was improperly applied. And so I think all those taken together support that position when we look at all the other cases that say it is, can be properly applied. So that's our view on it, I think, but it also goes into the premises issue, maintaining the premises, because the facts in the case show that there's no drug transactions or distribution from the apartment. And I think that's...
But there's no indication of any other use that premises would have been used for. In other words, no indication of some other people living there or that sort of thing.
Well, there was indication that some people, Mr. Cascio, was living there because there were clothes found in the closet. And so there were clothes there that would indicate someone could live there. But I agree that it wasn't like a standard residence in that sense, that somebody was living there full time. But there was an issue that Mr. Castro had clothes in the closet is there as well. I think the other thing, too, that makes this case different in that there's no drugs found in the house is the level of surveillance that was occurred in the case. And I think one of the things that's kind of stuck out to me is in the PSR, on page 278 of the record, it's paragraph 16 that they indicated that they had used GPS location data from Mr. Castro's phone. And I think that's critical because in all the transactions that occurred, you see Mr. Castro arriving at locations and delivering cocaine and coming back with proceeds, that there's nothing in the GPS data that connects the picking up of cocaine from that location. And I think with the amount of surveillance and the lack of evidence in there, it doesn't support the premises enhancement. And I think what's important about that is the guideline application note talks about the manufacturing and distribution of a controlled substance from that location. And they did not include, you know, drug proceeds. So I think that's critical, that there's no evidence in the record that there's any manufacture or distribution of controlled substance, in this case cocaine, from that apartment to support the premises enhancement in that case. So I think that's important. And I think also the other point I'd like to make is that they focus, it seemed to be a focus of the court and the government in sentencing, that Mr. Castro signed a factual resume that he engaged in drug trafficking activities. And it seemed to be used as the basis to support those enhancements. We would point to the Lee case that basically stood for the proposition that we cite in our reply brief, that statement in a factual resume is insufficient by itself to support that conclusion. So I think that is a critical fact, that it's just based on a statement in a factual resume. He never states, I use that apartment to transport drugs, store drugs, pick up drugs. There's none of that, none of those statements in the record, which in some other cases the courts have found, because they made statements, I use the apartment for drug trafficking or store drugs there, that was sufficient, but we don't have that in this case. It's just simply a statement that was part of his drug trafficking activities. And so I think that's important in the case for the court to look at.
Would you please speak up? I can't hear you.
And I think that's important for the court to review, because I think these facts are different and unique because there's not any drugs or drug paraphernalia at the location. And I think that's important.
He admitted that he used the apartment in his
very profitable drug distribution system. You had a million and a quarter cash in the apartment and $250,000 of jewelry, and which he admits, I think, that were proceeds of his business. He had another house that he lived in, and he had no other income except for a minor amount of income that he did for his father, carpentry or something. So, you know, all of that together, to me, shows that he admitted using the apartment in his drug dealings. So we don't know what that entailed. Maybe that's shows an insufficient case by the government, but I'm not sure. But it is pretty indicative that he used the apartment for meetings or telephone calls or something in connection with his distribution.
And I can agree that that could become a reasonable inference, but for the evidence in the record about the level and degree of surveillance that was done in this case, that there's nothing in the record or the PSR that ties the surveillance law enforcement did back to that apartment. There's a disconnect, and since there's no drug trafficking coming out of that apartment, they had his cell phone, and they were up on a Title III wiretap that he was at the apartment while he negotiated drug deals. There's nothing in the record to support that it was used for the manufacturing and distribution of a controlled substance. I agree that he stored proceeds there, but for the enhancement to apply under the premises.
Well, he admitted he used the apartment in his drug dealings, didn't he?
Well, it drug trafficking activities, but the enhancement, to me, is very specific that it has to be for the manufacturing and distribution of a controlled substance, and the cases suggest that there has to be controlled substances or paraphernalia in conjunction for that enhancement to apply. And we don't, and the record is lacking, and there's no evidence in the record to support that was the location where he negotiated drug deals, delivered drugs from, despite the level of surveillance that they had in this particular case. Now, I think if there was a phone call where he's located there negotiating a deal, I could agree with the court with that premise that yes, that would be, but not under the facts that we have in this case. It's the insufficient evidence of phone calls, transactions from the apartment to support the enhancement.
Was there any evidence of where he was storing the drugs?
No.
That's what was odd to me. He was under such heavy surveillance, and he would always come from somewhere other than this apartment, apparently, with drugs. Why didn't they know where he was getting the drugs?
I do not know. I mean, I think that's a point that stuck out to me, that with this level of surveillance, was there another house or location that he was picking up his source of supply or a warehouse? I think that the lack of that information is critical to the evaluation of both enhancements in the case. And I agree with you on that, because that was interesting to me, that despite this level of surveillance, they couldn't pinpoint a location of where he was picking up from and delivering the cocaine. And so I think that is super important in the analysis of both enhancements in the case.
You said they could not. I don't know if they couldn't, but did they? Was that question asked of them? Did you?
It's not, since this was a sentencing, not presented.
They didn't volunteer the information.
And the government didn't put on any evidence at sentencing to kind of shore that up or close that gap. My time's running out, but one thing I did want to touch on real quick is Judge Crone did say, even if I'm wrong, I still would have imposed the same sentence. We'd ask the court to look at the Ritchie case that we cited. In the Ritchie case, Judge Crone sentenced him within the guidelines that she calculated. In the Ritchie case, since the loss calculation was incorrect, just the blanket statement was insufficient to make it harmless, and therefore, we'd ask the court to reverse its convictions and reverse its sentence and the enhancements. Thank you.
You've saved time for rebuttal. Thank you, Mr. Whalen. Mr. Anderson?
Good morning. As the court's aware, this is a case that involves the question, did the district court err in finding that the statutory offense characteristics, in this case, 2D1.1, subsection B, 1 and 12, apply? The evidence in this case substantiates that she did not, that Judge Crone did not err, and in fact, she was, she made a very prudent finding in finding they both apply. Let's take these both piecemeal. Let's start with the firearm. That firearm is in a closet. This, first of all, take a step back with regard to this apartment. This apartment is Spartan living. I probably have more personal effects in my hotel room right now than are in this apartment. Master bedroom closet, large closet, suitcase on the floor, open, $1,050,000. I did some calculations on my calculator as I was sitting here this morning. That's $10,500 bills in one suitcase. You've got no garments belonging to anybody but him, and you only got a few shirts, a few pair of pants, and a gun case with a gun and a magazine in it. That is clearly, anybody looking at that set of facts would say that gun is clearly there in conjunction with those drug proceeds, because we all agree that there are drug proceeds in that club. Anybody looking at this objectively would say that the two are tied. That was not a stretch in this case, and I don't think that that should be found to be an error. With regard to the drug premises argument in this case, the government completely disagrees that there's no evidence to substantiate that this condo that we're talking about was used as a drug premises in this case. When you look at the factual basis in this case, and starting, this would be in the docket from page 78 through 80, and I'm going to start at paragraph N and go through paragraph T. But what you have there, and this is within a 24-hour period, if you look at the dates on those paragraphs, everyone, when I drafted, every one of those is dated. You have three transactions that are occurring with substantial amounts of cocaine. And Castro, is the defendant in this case, is negotiating each one of those transactions. The first one that he deals with, Roderick Smith, 14, started out to be 15 kilos of cocaine, moved to 14 kilos of cocaine, but then the transaction was effectuated, and we know it was effectuated because after the fact, they're talking back and forth about how there's four different cartel trademarks stamped on the various cocaine kilos in this case. And they thought that was interesting on the wire. Second transaction would have been with Sonny Williams. 2 to 3 kilos. It originally was supposed to be 2 kilos, but up to a 3 kilo of cocaine transaction. And those were, he was then, we know that was effectuated because after that was effectuated, law enforcement stopped him and confiscated the cocaine off of him. We were able to monitor now and that, effectuate a stop was it, on
was,
that transaction.
Was that at the apartment?
No, not at the apartment yet. But I will come back to that, I promise you, in just one second after I flush out the third of these transactions.
Well, how close to the apartment was it?
I don't know the answer to that, but the apartment is in downtown Houston. All of these transactions are occurring somewhere in the central Houston metropolitan area. I can't give you an exact with miles, though, as I stand here. But the third transaction, this one's interesting. This one was with Irvin Castillo, and that was originally supposed to be a 4 kilo transaction, but it became a 2 kilo transaction because there was no cocaine. Now you go back to the house, because the reason why the search warrant is effectuated that day is because all these transactions are going on. And I'm going to dispute something that we said, as defense counsel was speaking to you, he was inferring that with all the geolocation information he had in this case, there was no indication he was there. That's simply not true. If you look in the docket, this is going to the detention hearing in this case, so I'm going to docket pages 163 through 164. Jason Havanen, who's the case agent in this case, says during the wiretap of Mr. Castro, he conducted 3 drug transactions in 1 day, and one of those drug transactions, and in one of those drug transactions would be intercepted by law enforcement with 3 kilos of cocaine, which was delivered to a co-defendant in this investigation. Subsequent to that, we had identified a location in downtown Houston that he was using as an aside from his main residence, where he currently lives, and we had identified that as a potential criminal location in furtherance of the crime, and a search warrant was drafted and executed in that location.
How thorough did you search for remnants of drugs?
Well, there's different types of drug stack premises in the environment. One is the one that we had in this case that would have been at 6219 Great Oaks, and that's what most people think of. That's the one where people are showing up night and day, and you can buy anything you want there, and it's operated by a criminal street gang. That is the first kind, and that's what people typically think of. This is a different kind. This unit that Rodney Castro has at 1475 Texas Avenue, Unit 402. Different kind. This is the kind nobody knows about. This is the kind where I keep my money, I keep my narcotics. Now, I'm going to submit to the court, the most logical finding is the reason why they don't find any narcotics there is because he's now out. He has done so many transactions that day.
Well, you would think you would find scales or packaging or something to indicate drugs had been there.
But a kilo comes in a heavily wrapped kilo brick. You don't need to, once you have a stack of, it's like a ream of printer paper. If I've got 5 reams of printer paper, I know I've got 5 reams. I don't have to weigh them or count the pages. I just assume that's what they are. That's how it works with kilos of cocaine. They come in bricks, and once you have 5 bricks, that's now your 5 kilos of cocaine. Once I break it down and I start transactioning ounces or smaller quantities, like at the first house I mentioned, that's when you're going to find scales and wrapping and all those kinds of things that we think about for street transactions. This is wholesale transactions that's going on at this unit. This is where he brings the product from Mexico, and it sits till he either fronts it to Nekia Bird Stash House at 6219 Great Oaks.
Well, do they have GPS data leading somewhere from the house to all these? Y'all, he was surveilled for a long time.
That's outside the record, but the answer is yes. Yes.
Why in the record?
Because that would have been in the original search warrant. The search warrant would have been a Houston search warrant, which is outside of our district. In hindsight, I wish it was, but that's not in our record. But what I am citing to you is in the record. The detention hearing is in the record. And there it discusses, later it discusses how they observed him that day, going to and from the stash house. That's in line 12 of page 164 in the docket. He had been observed driving in and out of the parking garage at that location several times. The question that he's talked about was, what was the connection between him and the house where we found $1 million? So he's obviously talking about our stash house here. This is the location where he was that day that he's doing the 3 transactions for 20 plus kilos of cocaine. This house was a drug premises. And at the very
how many times was he seen driving in and out of the garage that day?
The record says several times.
What is your closest case, if you know of one, regarding the premises enhancement, where there was, as Judge Richman discussed, absolutely no direct evidence of either drugs, drug residue, paraphernalia of any kind?
I can cite you one case that would be directly on point, but it's a Fifth Circuit case, however it is not published, so it's persuasive only. But that would be the Meza case, which is cited in my brief. That was a case where he was similar to this. He's a known drug trafficker, but when they do a search warrant on his house, they don't find any narcotics, they just find money. Similar to that, though, the best case we have is the Fifth Circuit case Moyen. Now, that deals with a different issue because that was a trial conviction, and at trial, he's convicted. Now, that's at the reasonable doubt standard. That's the highest standard there. and he's convicted on a 924C, so that's possession of a firearm in furtherance of the drug conspiracy. And when he's found with it, you've got $200,000 in two boxes in a closet, and you have a third box in the closet with him that's got the firearm. That's almost exactly what we have here.
But that's a transaction. You know, we're looking at the guideline. It says manufacturing or distributing. That's not, or in furtherance of a scheme to manufacture.
Because in the Sabalos factors, it says trafficking in narcotics or drug proceeds. So it's a little different, but it's a very similar fact pattern.
What's the name of that case?
That would be Moyen. One second.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's all right.
It is United States of America versus Armando Moya, and it is 18F4480. I would also submit to the court this. The lifeblood of drug trafficking is money. Drug trafficking does not exist but for money. There's a reason in the Sabalos factors.
So why didn't the guidelines say proceeds? That's money, proceeds. It doesn't say manufacturing, distributing, or proceeds. It just says for the premises, for the purposes of manufacturing or distributing a controlled substance.
I'm arguing an alternative now because I'm not backing down. I believe that the narcotics were there that day and he was out. I believe that's what the factual basis points to. But that said, I'm not.
That's a lot closer. That you can draw. Can you draw a reasonable inference that there had been drugs there?
Absolutely.
Apart from that, I have a hard time finding that it fits within premises if there have never been drugs there.
There's basically two arguments. The first is with the amount of cocaine he trafficked that day, and the fact that when you look at the Irvin Castillo transaction, and that never culminates in four, it goes down to two, he doesn't have any more cocaine is the most plausible explanation for that. And I believe that's why when you get to the house, there's no longer any cocaine there. I don't think that's a stretch at all. I think circumstantially that is what the situation was. However, I do also believe that just the amount of money that's there also shows that this was a premises that existed for the purpose of drug narcotics trafficking.
What about phone calls? That's the other point. They say did they have GPS tracking data on where phone calls were made when he was actually arranging these drug transactions?
Yes.
Where does that show he was?
At that point in time, he's all over because he's in a vehicle meeting with these people. You never meet with them at your stack. You don't want anybody to know it's there. So he's out and about driving around meeting with them. And then he goes back to this place periodically throughout that day. So this is how the record reads, at least at the detention level on page 164 of the docket.
So there's never ever one location twice where it was in the same spot where he was making the phone calls for him to set up the deals.
No, I believe he's probably making on his cell phone in his car. Because law enforcement is surveilling him.
I'm just saying, is it a fact or not? Does the GPS data ever, where at least twice, two or three times, he was in the same spot?
No, I don't believe he was.
Is that
other than the house, he would be at the house, but I don't even know if he's making phone calls there. I have to look at the data.
Well, that's kind of important to know, isn't it?
Where he's making the phone calls, I don't know that necessarily connects with where the narcotics are being stored. Well, I don't think that
you're asking us to draw an inference one way but not the other. I'm just saying, I'm just trying to hear what the evidence is.
Yes, I don't know that there's any evidence that he's making the phone calls from the apartment that day. Previous days that would be true, but not that day.
So he did make drug transaction calls from that apartment.
I believe memory serves, I think it's in paragraph 15 of the search warrant where they discussed he made a call to Necky and Bird and then left from the stash house and brought narcotics to the Great Oaks stash house at that point in time, the one that Nagy Bird was from, the other stash house, that he would supply. Finally, with regard to the district court's statement in this case, that Judge Cohen would have made the same finding in this case, irrespective of wherever the guidelines came out at, based upon what the facts presented to her were. I don't think that that, I think that that's perfectly acceptable, Your Honors, given the fact that you've got $1 million in cash attributed to this individual. You've got all the multitude of transactions that he shows up at the Great Oaks location, where he's, you know, he is the principal supplier for that location on the pole campus over there. So I don't think finding that he is at the top of the pyramid in this case and deserved the sentence he had is something that should be overturned in this case.
What do you do with the Ritchie case that Mr. Whalen cited?
I would say that based upon the evidence that was presented at sentencing, and she had in her factual basis and in the PSR, there's ample evidence that she would have before her to make the sentencing decision that she had made. And I would just stand on that in this case. Thank you, Your Honors, and I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Whalen for rebuttal.
Just briefly, I think what's important is what Judge Crone relied on to make these decisions. Mr. Anderson talked about what would maybe in the search warrant or at the detention hearing, but that's not based on the record what Judge Crone relied on to reach her decisions about whether to apply the enhancements and what she stated on the record. So I think it's important that when we confine what Judge Crone relied on in the case, that neither enhancements should have applied. And so I think that's important in the case. And I think whether or not they had GPS data, the only reference about GPS location data in the record is in the PSR at paragraph 16. There's no other evidence presented at the sentencing hearing presented to Judge Crone.
Well, back to the enhancements themselves. Are the search warrants in the record?
I don't believe they are. I did not see the search warrants. No, they are not in the record. So we can't say that Judge Crone reviewed them or relied on them.
Well, I'm just trying, again, not on the sentencing issue, but on whether it was proper to impose that second enhancement. You're saying the search warrants were not in the record.
That is correct.
So is there any other GPS data in the record we could look at?
Not that I see. The only GPS data reference to GPS location data from his phone was in paragraph 16 in the pre-sentence report, which is on page 278 of the record.
What's our standard of review here?
So we took the position on the standard of review that because the facts necessarily are not in dispute, what was in the record is that it is a de novo review because it's a typical legal conclusion. And what the court under U.S. Zapata Lara. But I know there's the cases have distinguished Zapata Lara because the issue is whether or not he had ownership, and it wasn't clear whether or not he had ownership. In this case, we do have ownership. And so there are cases that say clear errors. We believe that it is de novo because, to me, it's a legal conclusion. She's applying the facts to the enhancement, and it's a legal conclusion that she made. But even if it is clear error, we believe we still prevail under either standard of review due to the lack of evidence in the record to support either enhancement.
But there was an objection to both enhancements at the sentencing hearing.
There were. Those were the two objections that were at the sentencing hearing was the firearm enhancement as well as the premises enhancement. And so those both were objected to. So under either standard, whether it's de novo or clear error, the evidence doesn't support the imposition of either enhancement. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Whalen. Your case is under submission, and We noticed that you're court-appointed. We wish to thank you for your willingness to take the appointment. You've done a good job as an officer of the court and on behalf of your client.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.